Hey, everybody, it's Jason. Before we get started with this episode, which I think you're going to love, I just want to mention you are listening to the free version of The Incomparable, and thank you for listening. If you don't want to hear a bunch of ads inserted in the episode, including this one, and to get episodes a little bit sooner and with a lot of bonus content, go to theincomparable.com/members, sign up. We've got plans starting at $5 a month or $60 a year. In addition to the special edition version of this podcast, which has no ads, you get it early, and it's got extra material that we cut from the main show. There's also so much more you get when you're a member. You get access to our bootleg recordings, which are posted immediately after we record an episode of this podcast or many of the other podcasts on the network. There's bonus material we drop in our first class feed. If you like Total Party Kill, all of those live sessions get posted as well. And there's a great member community on Discord that you get access to. So many reasons to become a member, especially if you're listening to this and you're like, you know what, I don't want to hear these ads anymore, I'm tired of it, we have a solution for you. $5 a month, $60 a year. There's other higher levels too, but pretty easy to get you in the door. Check it out, theincomparable.com/members. And regardless, thank you for listening to The Incomparable. On with the show!
The Incomparable, number 680, August 2023.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to The Incomparable, and to an echo of a little show called Unjustly Maligned, with which an increasingly small number of you may be familiar. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and once upon a time, back in the long ago days of 2015, I launched a show on this very network called Unjustly Maligned. The premise of the show was simple. I invited a guest to tell me why something that most people think is terrible, a movie, a book, a TV show, a game, whatever, is actually really great, at least in their opinion, and during the show I ask them to explain and defend it. This is not quite that show, because for one thing today I have more than one guest, but think of it as an homage by popular demand. And because this is the Incomparable Mothership and we love a draft, yes, this is going to be a draft, although I suspect the chances of anyone getting sniped on this particular episode are pretty low. So joining me, and hopefully not getting sniped, are Chip Suddeth. Hello, Chip.
Hi. Well, I guess I am going to get one through, but I'm expecting that I'm going to be sniped and sniped and sniped again because it's me.
That would be hilarious if you don't get sniped at all. I'll love it. We also have Gene McDonald. Hello, Gene.
Oh, hi. I'm excited to not be sniped, and so I guess hopefully I'm getting one of mine through, and Chip and I don't have the exact same list.
No, this isn't mind meld. We don't want that. We also have Sarah Bickton. Sarah, welcome.
Hi. I just feel like I'm being given the opportunity to show how bad my taste in films is.
That's exactly what Unjustly Maligned was always about. And finally, we surely could not do a show like this without him. It's Monty Ashley.
I think it's weird that the people who are drafting first are worried about getting sniped, and I'm not worried about getting sniped at all.
Oh, I don't think that's strange at all. That's exactly what I would expect from you. By the way, just so everybody out there knows, the original Unjustly Maligned show can still be found at theincomparable.com/UMP. There were 87 episodes. Yeah, there were 87 episodes, and you will hear a couple of the same voices there that you will hear on this show, but not all. I'm still pretty proud of that show, actually. I mean, one of the reasons that I started it, one of the things that I think made it stand out, was it had a focus on positivity. Like, mm-hmm. There's, you know, part of the philosophy behind it was there's a million places online where you can go and find people who will tear down something popular. But there are precious few places where you can find people giving love to something that's unpopular. And so I thought that was, you know, that was a good thing to do. And it's what the show was all about.
Well, thank goodness we don't need any more positivity online anymore. And that's totally taken care of.
We've had
the unjustly maligned piece of the podcast was that it was unjustly retired, Anthony.
Yeah, well, you know, life gets in the way. But here we are today. Now, today we are focusing just on movies in this particular show. So I am asking all of the panelists here to draft, because again, this is a draft, movies which were critical disasters and or box office flops, and then convince me and everybody else that they shouldn't have been, and that those movies are, in fact, unjustly maligned. And we're going to go around the panel in the same order in which I introduced them, which Monty, being an old hand, knew and mentioned earlier. So that means, Chip, we start with you. What is your first pick?
Well, my initial thought for my first pick would have been to break the rules a little bit. Once upon a time, Moises drafted all of soccer. I was tempted to draft all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which has fallen on some hard times recently, certainly critically. And then the more I thought about it, the more that, no, it's kind of justly maligned to the state that it's in today. So I'm going to narrow focus.
Also, it's kind of hard to justify saying that one of the, possibly the most successful series of movies in history is unjustly marred. I don't think that really counts.
Absolutely. But it is fashionable to have fun at the expense of, you know, if something's got too popular, it's time to take it down a few pegs. But I am going to pick a specific Marvel movie that hasn't come across very well, but I actually kind of love. And no, it's not Thor 2. It is Eternals.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
I claim Eternals as being an unjustly maligned movie.
Why?
Eternals star the cast of Eternals is weird and fascinating. Angelina Jolie as a superhero, Kumail Nanjiani as a superhero. There is a level of Jack Kirby weirdness that really hasn't been applied to a lot of other Marvel movies. It's still recognizably part of the Marvel formula, but there is some weirdness and independence to it. And I adore the cast. I adore the cast and the family relationship between the cast members. The Eternals have been hiding on Earth, protecting humanity from the Deviants for thousands of years, and the members of the Eternals are more family than generic super team, and they relate to each other that way. Characters like Fastos, Kingo, are just delightful and entertaining, and there is a the reveal of the villain 2/3 of the way through the movie comes as a surprise to anyone who wasn't paying close attention to the trailer. But it's just big and weird, and it has the potential, if they actually follow through with it, and I think there's a question of it, of expanding the scope of the MCU into some more weirdness, as opposed to your Secret Invasions and your Falcon and the Winter Soldiers and some of the missteps on the television front. I love it. I love it. I recognize that it's not perfect, but I do think that it is not only unjustly maligned, but unjustly, I think it was regarded as the chink in the armor for the supposed decline of the MCU, and I just don't think that that's fair.
I seem to recall that a lot of the criticism about it was that it was just really slow and like overly long as well,
which may be a justly maligned bit, but I don't care, Anthony. I don't care. Yeah.
Isn't there, though, like a planet-sized statue sticking out of half the Earth that nobody has mentioned in any series since that film?
I think it's best to think of Eternals as a standalone and not actually part of the MCU. That fixes a lot of the problems.
Yeah, like Marvel's equivalent of Elseworlds or something.
Yeah. I think that there was a tossed off line in one episode. Sure. This is also the movie that supposedly set up, Harry Styles' introduction to the MCU, and that can be a pro or a con if you like. But I don't care. It's weird, and therefore I like it.
Well, weird is generally a good thing here on Just Limaligned. So, yeah. Wow, Eternals. I did not expect that to be the first first pick. So, well done. Jean, what about you? What's your first pick?
Well, back in 2017, when I first joined this podcast community and with my show, Sestracast, I proposed a Unjustly Maligned episode to you, Anthony, that we were going to do, but just never got scheduled, and then the show was no more. So I have to start with that movie from 1995, and it's Waterworld.
Oh, my yes. I remember that you suggested that.
Yes, I am such a huge Waterworld fan. It's kind of embarrassing, but not really, because I do think it is a great film in a lot of ways. Unjustly Maligned doesn't mean that it is also a masterpiece. I would not say that, but it is one of my favorite pieces of entertainment ever. And so Waterworld, just from the moment that the movie starts with the Universal, you know, logo, the Earth, and then the ice caps melt and the whole Earth in the actual, you know, Universal logo is just one big ball of water. That's Waterworld. And then has everyone seen it? I mean, it doesn't really matter.
I saw it in the theater when it came out.
Of course I've seen it. Who are you talking to?
Yes, okay. So I don't want, I mean, obviously spoilers for it.
For a
30-year-old really
movie, yeah, don't worry about that.
A 30-year-old movie that, even if you haven't seen it, you probably think you've seen most of it, because there's a lot, you know, people know about Waterworld. I remember when it came out in the theater, and I didn't go. I'm not sure exactly why, but it coincided with a summer I was living with my parents as an adult. And my brother came and moved in too. So there was two of us, adult children in the house, staying up late at night, surfing cable television, which was, it wasn't new in 1995, but it was, it's nothing like it is today. So we stumbled across Waterworld on cable, and we probably started somewhere in the middle. I said, this is that movie Waterworld that everybody thinks is terrible. And then we just watched whatever part of it we watched, and we watched it like at least 10 more times that summer because we loved it. Now, we are from Miami, Florida, so we're, you know, fans of the ocean and of big sailing boats and all that. And that was a so just watching those sequences, I think one of the things about Waterworld, you know, which it was expensive. It was the most expensive movie for its time. Came in at like a crazy $175 million in 1995. And that, you know, a big part of that was they built the sets on the water. They were they're filming, you know, on the water itself instead of using a lot of special effects. And the set got destroyed by a hurricane, and they had to rebuild it. And I think that it had so many high profile, you know, disasters, and probably there's some like element of like, oh, not Kevin Costner again, thinking he can do anything. So I credit that as well. You know, I think there was
a bit
blood
of Costner
in the water,
fatigue.
Literally. Yeah. Costner fatigue. And when it was known to be, you know, just ridiculously expensive, and it, it was never going to be a smash box office hit in relative to its budget. But so I actually love Kevin Costner in this. I think he was the one to play the role, because it's, his character is this like mysterious mutant humanoid floating around, very self-sufficient, completely self-sufficient with his sailboat. Not necessarily a do-gooder at all, but you know, just like the, it was a bit of a Western. Of course, it was also called Mad Max on the Water. But he was the right, I think, the right actor to play that like mysterious type person. I mean, none of the characters are super fleshed out in any sense. Not, but the there then there's Dennis Hopper, who is just a joy to watch in this, I think.
It and is one of also, Hopper's most madcap performances, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, then there's even a small cameo with Jack Black, you know, young Jack Black.
Really?
And yep, he's the pilot of the plane. There's a plane that comes after them, one of the smokers' planes, and gets shot by their harpoon weapon on the catamaran, and eventually, like, you know, I mean, they shoot him down, but he's like a crazy, insane pilot. I mean, all those followers of Dennis Hopper's character are kind of insane. I mean, that's part of the story. So, yeah, and using the Exxon Valdez as a plot point, and finally using Mount Everest as a plot point, I think it was just so much fun. And I will fight anyone who tries to tell me it's not worth sitting down for 2 hours and 39 minutes to watch it.
That was the other thing. Yeah, I'd forgotten how long it was. I suppose it was a swing for the fences thing, wasn't it? But good Lord, yeah.
Can I shout out the Waterworld stunt show really quickly?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, where's that?
Oh, wow.
The Waterworld stunt show opened in Hollywood, Universal Studios Hollywood, October 1995. That's just a few months after the movie came out. It opened in Japan in 2001. It opened in Singapore 2010. Universal Studios Beijing opened in 2021. It has a Waterworld stunt show in it. The Waterworld stunt show is the best of the stunt shows you can see at theme parks. It's incredible.
Is it still going at Universal?
Yes, it's still going at all five of those Universal parks.
Wow.
It's a worldwide phenomenon.
For a movie that most people watching that have probably never seen.
That's right. For a 28-year-old movie.
That is crazy. All right. Well, all right. Waterworld. Thank you, Gene. Who's next? Sarah, what have you got for us from the first round?
Okay. So I thought I could have sworn this was going to get sniped. Maybe it's because David's not here.
And I told you, I don't think there's going to be as much sniping here as you all seem to think.
Okay.
We're in terror of this thing.
Yeah. I'm going back to an old, well, it's the movie itself is not that old, but I have loved the directors of this film since a really weird, and I do mean weird, indie film came out in the 90s called Bound. And and nobody, and I'm not picking Bound because nobody knows Bound.
I know Bound.
Everybody but it was knows and loves Bound.
It's a loved film, and it's an amazing. If you haven't seen Bound, good Lord, go see Bound. I feel like it's like Gen X queer women of a certain age, just like this is just like manna from heaven. But anyway, leaving aside Bound, this film, I've enjoyed it. And I go back and rewatch it, and I don't care how many people poke fun at this film, because it's like this wonderful warm bath of visuals, and its scope is huge, which is like one of my like happy places, is films with scope and incredible world building, like unnecessary world building, which is my pinnacle for things I absolutely love, is completely unnecessary deep world building for a film that just doesn't need it. And I think you all know where I'm going. This is Jupiter Ascending.
Nice. Which could have been Cloud Atlas, though.
Jupiter Ascending was on Unjustly Maligned.
Was it really?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, then Okay.
Yeah.
Given my long distance love for Serenity Caldwell, I'm calling that definitely because this film is glorious. If not for the all time best line of all films everywhere, I have always loved dogs.
Yeah.
Because I mean, really, it's beautiful. I kind of headcanon, I don't know if this is true, but that the Wachowskis were setting this up for a new multi-film universe.
Oh, it was meant to be a franchise, no question.
Post Matrix kind of reboot. Creating a new space. And that's why we have all this deep world building. And you can see it. It's like, again, it's unnecessary. The fact that apparently bees can recognize royalty. Yes.
Don't forget the hover skates.
The hover skates. Oh, I love them
Johnny
so
rocket
much.
Boots.
Oh, the rocket boots. Oh, that was so good. It's like I could go into multiple reasons. If you want to get into a deep dive of why this is such a good film.
Well, summarize for us, why do you think it's unjustly maligned? I mean, that's the, you know, that's the purpose of it. What is it that you think actually people are missing about it?
Okay, so the major thing that I love about films, and this may be a Sarah thing, but I don't think I'm the only one. It's beautiful. It is like the visuals are incredible. The Wachowskis got given this budget to create something that was just over the top and incredible and gorgeous. And the visuals and the background and the special effects are incredible. And it almost doesn't matter how silly and clunky a lot of the dialogue is, because it is. But it's this thing that you can just lose yourself into this wondrous beauty. The scene I particularly like was the bureaucracy scene where they're trying to get, it's completely out of my head.
Jupiter Jones,
which is a total head fake because, in the background poster, movie film poster, they actually have Jupiter in the background. and it's nothing to do with the planet Jupiter. But
well,
regardless.
No, they do go to Jupiter.
They do go to Jupiter, but
they,
it's
they
like
fly
it's
through
about,
the red spot. You know,
they go fly through the red spot, but it's about Jupiter. Anyway, the scene where she's getting going through the bureaucracy is this wonderful deep dive into a particular American bureaucracy because nobody does bureaucracy like Americans do. And it's just, this wonderful piece of commentary. And it does this throughout the film. And I think that's particularly for me is that beauty, that depth that this film has no rights having. And yet it does. And I think, that's why it's unjustly maligned.
So I really liked A Jupiter's Ascending. I had no intention of watching it until Serenity said she wanted to do it for the show. And so I watched it and I immediately loved it. And everything you said there is true. But the reason I loved it is because it's fun. It's so much fun. Everybody's having a good time and you can tell. And there's flippancy and it's fun to watch. And the best description I ever saw of it was that it is Dune for 14-year-old girls who live on Tumblr. And I think
it totally is.
It's so accurate and that's why I love it. Because it's got that crazy chaotic joy that something like that would have. I absolutely love Jupiter Ascending. I wish they had made more.
Sean Bean being broody and sad.
Being Sean Bean,
being Sean Bean. It's like, what more can you say? And absolutely. Then Eddie Redmayne chewing every single piece of scenery.
Devouring
like,
it, yeah.
Just devouring it like he's like hasn't eaten for like 12 years and was just like munching his way through everything. It was just, oh, If you haven't seen this film, go see this film.
All right. Finally then, Monty, what have you got for us on your first pick?
Well, Jupiter Ascending was very high on my list, but the top of my list... So you guys know how Margot Robbie is in Barbie, which is making $1 billion right now?
Mm-hmm.
Before Barbie, she was called box office poison, which is crazy, just because she was in a movie called Babylon.
Oh,
Babylon cost $80 million and only made $63 million. Clearly a flop, clearly counts. I love Babylon so much.
What a world we live in where a movie that takes in $63 million is considered a flop.
Look, it cost $80 million.
I know it counts. I'm just saying it's what a crazy world.
It also got some pretty bad reviews, I think. People were put off by it being over 3 hours. Also, the way the main character, one of the main character gets absolutely covered in elephant dung right at the top of the movie kind of put people off. Here's the thing. The thesis of Babylon is that making movies is a horrible job full of every indignity one can imagine. And it's all worth it. So Babylon has these scenes of people just killing themselves to make a movie. And you're thinking, this is dumb. What are you doing? You're going to get yourself killed. Come on, stop it. And then you see the movie they make and you go, oh, it's so beautiful. I love movies. And then they go back to making the movies and it's horrible again. I think of Babylon as a love letter to cinema. I'm sorry. Also, there are wild sex party scenes in this movie. Really, really wild sex party scenes. Like, the movie is named after, I think, the book Hollywood Babylon, but it goes full... I can't describe the sex party scenes. You just have to experience them. They are crazy, and they have an amazing soundtrack. The soundtrack in Babylon is so good. So Babylon is a maximalist movie. It has everything in it, and some people can't handle it, and I can. Let's put it that way. I love Babylon.
Wow. And it's crazy that, like, one movie like that can be considered box office poison. Because, I mean, that came, if I remember correctly, that came after she'd already played Harley Quinn in the DCU
Also
movies.
A bomb.
Well, sure, but she was generally considered to be one of the best things in those movies.
And she's one of the best things in Babylon. But if you keep making movies that don't make money, that's what happens.
Yeah, I guess.
So I'm glad that she's made a movie that made all the money in the world, and now she gets to do whatever she wants.
She's certainly redeemed herself now, yeah. I mean, Barbie, at time of recording, I think is number 2 for the year worldwide.
it's just behind Super Mario Brothers.
Right, and it's on track to possibly overtake Super Mario Brothers before the year's out, because it just seems to be keep running and running. But yeah, Babylon, wow. What a pick.
Babylon's an incredible movie.
It's a very long movie, my goodness.
Yeah, it is.
This is a complete aside, but I will say I am not a fan of the modern trend for 2.5 to 3 hour movies. That's like, I'm an old man. I cannot sit in the cinema for that long. That's just...
Well, Babylon picks you up with these exciting sex party scenes every 20 minutes or so.
Oh, dear, that doesn't help.
Let's take a brief break from the podcast to tell you about our sponsor. This episode of The Incomparable is brought to you by Factor. The busy fall season is just around the corner. You might be looking for some wholesome, convenient meals for your jam-packed days. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit, and it can help you fuel up fast with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. You'll save time, eat well, and stay on track with your healthy lifestyle. I have tried Factor's meals. You know, the thing that I liked the most about them is the high quality of the ingredients. To be frank, I have gotten some things in the mail, like boxes to my door that contain stuff that was iffy, not very good. I get these chicken meals from Factor, and it's like white meat chicken, and it's really high quality. The veggies are high quality. Just very impressed. This is not one of those random sort of things where you're like, mystery meat, what is it? It's just really good, high quality stuff. With Factor, you can skip the extra trip to the grocery store. They have fresh, never frozen meals, and they're ready in just 2 minutes. 34 different flavor-packed options to choose from every week. And if you want something special, and I know you do, level up with Gourmet Plus options prepared to perfection by chefs and ready to eat in record time so you can treat yourself to upscale meals with premium ingredients like broccolini, leeks, truffle butter, and asparagus. Like I said, they're ingredients. They're really good. And keep up your energy with lunch to go. Factor's effortless wholesome meals like grain bowls and salad toppers, no microwave required at all. And then to finish your order, you can throw in 45 different add-ons, including breakfast items like apple cinnamon pancakes, bacon and cheddar egg bites, and smoothies. And you can rest assured you're making a sustainable choice because Factor offsets 100% of their delivery emissions to your door, along with sourcing renewable electricity and featuring sustainably sourced seafood. Head to factormeals.com/snell50, that's my last name and the number 50, and use code snell50, that's the one, to get 50% off your first box. That's code snell50, snell50, at factormeals.com/snell50 to get 50% off your first box. Thank you to Factor for supporting The Incomparable.
Back around then. Round two. Chip, what have you got for us?
Did you say you don't like long movies?
Oh no. What have I done?
Did you say you don't like slow-paced movies?
Well, that depends what it is.
Do you say you don't like ponderous movies that try to say more than perhaps they're effectively telling? Do you say you don't like franchise movies?
Oh, okay. I was just about to say, is this a Chris Nolan movie? But maybe not then. All right.
It is not. It
he
is
makes a, franchise it, movies. What are you talking about?
He made one franchise movie.
He made three Dark Knight movies, Anthony. No, sorry. But Dark Knight, Batman, DC, franchise.
I meant one franchise. He's made one series of franchise movies.
Oh, but, okay. Retracted.
Yeah. Well, this is a movie that started a franchise. This is a movie that has gotten some level of redemption after the fact. People are sort of re-evaluating it. But it's certainly not beloved. And it spent a long time being kicked around and honestly being described as a motionless picture.
Okay, now I know what it is.
I am absolutely talking about Star Trek, The Motion Picture.
Which is an excellent film. I rewatched it myself.
I love that film!
Yeah, I rewatched it myself not that long ago. And yes, it is slow and everything, but it's still really good. And it looks gorgeous.
You compare it to Wrath of Khan and things like that, and that was sort of that moment that crystallized everybody's opinion that, you know, this slow movie was just not very good, not when you compare it to Ricardo Montalban chewing the scenery. But Star Trek The Motion Picture has a lot going for it, maybe not in the costume department, but absolutely in terms of just being about something different than Star Wars reset everybody's expectations for what science fiction cinema could be. And Star Trek The Motion Picture actually straddles the line between the old 2001 idea of cerebral science fiction.
Say boring. Just say boring. It's fine.
Well, so many people called Star Trek 1 boring, too. And it's not it is slow, but I don't think it's boring. I do think that it captures enough of the personalities of the old characters and the old TV show while raising the stakes, threatening Earth for the first time, having really excellent special effects. It reintroduces everybody to the characters, and it presents the promise of another 5-year mission of honest to God, strange new worlds. Everybody's reaction here. I suppose that this was an easy one to pick that would nobody would actually call it maligned these days, or at least most of the folks on this panel wouldn't call it maligned.
But I think
it has
a lot of the
been
public
heavily
still
maligned
would.
In the past.
Yeah.
I think
a lot
it's
of
maligned.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of critics and the public would call it, would malign it for sure. But I'm on your side. Yeah, I agree.
Rescued by Star Trek V. And it was no longer, well, I mean, maybe three,
no longer the worst of the TOS movies.
No, I think that's fair. When it came out, people were like, this is the worst Star Trek movie. Now, well, there's lots worse Star Trek movies than this.
Yeah. I'm totally with you, Chip. As I say, I rewatched it recently and I maintain, yes, it is slow and the costumes are not great. DeForest Kelly's outfit and that false beard especially are, that's pretty woeful.
The special edition edit makes it even longer.
Yes, that's the one I saw.
Yeah, and you watch it and you listen to it, and you know that Gene Roddenberry loved it to bits, which is why that he basically tries to recreate it when he does Next Generation. Doesn't matter.
Yes,
I love
indeed. It. Right, but I maintain that at the core of it, the concept, the V'ger story is brilliant, and that is exactly the sort of cerebral sci-fi idea that I love. And so, yeah, that rescues the whole movie for me. I mean, there are good performances in it as well, but yeah, the central V'ger concept just rescues it all for me because I love that. Who's next? Gene, what have you got for us on your second pick?
Well, I'll tell you what I want. What I really, really want.
Oh, yes!
Oh, no!
Oh, you're for it. You
oh,
you've
got a theme going.
About?
I get it.
I've got a special edition box set of this downstairs.
Yes, the 1997 Spice World. I actually had kind of forgotten about this, and I was like, what's going to be on my list? Like, I knew Waterworld, obviously, but then Wannabe, the song from which I was just quoting, for those who don't know, I put it on the music to wash dishes with, and that came on, and I'm like, oh my God, Spice World, obvious pick. Somebody else will pick it because it's so obvious, but here I am taking it off the board. I love Spice World. I saw it when it came out in the theater because I had two young nieces visiting me, and they, of course, were Spice fans, Spice Girl. I don't know, is there a name for Spice Girl fans? But
I'm not sure, actually.
You know, it's
girl
power. I was at the time 36 or 7, and so I was not really a fan of the Spice Girls. I wasn't really paying that much attention, and they wanted to go see it, and of course, that's part of my always my strategy to be the favorite aunt is you never say no. And I said, sure, let's go. And I had the, I mean, I suppose it always helps. Like I had the absolute lowest expectations. And by the end of it, I was like, that was awesome. That was so much fun. It's such a fun movie. Unfortunately, there's just like a sexist bias against five girls doing a movie, you know, that is pretty much what the Beatles did with Hard Day's Night, you know, but
having the audacity to do one that is self-aware. That's the other thing. Like it is quite, quite meta, this movie, in many places.
Yes. And it's self-aware. It's, they know what they're doing, and they portray themselves as, you know, as women with total agency over what they're doing. They really, they're brave and they're smart and they're creative and they're the best friends, not just to each other, but also to their friend who's pregnant. And, you know, it was a movie that, so recently I took a class, on, a series called, Soundtracked, bands playing themselves in film. And it started with A Hard Day's Night and wrapped with Spice World. And we'd also watched Can't Stop the Music, which the teacher would argue is one of the best movies ever made. I racked my brain. I thought, no, I just can't, even though I enjoyed watching it with them, stick up for their point of view. The instructor, Max, who was awesome, but Max also said this Spice World before we watch this, they said it's a feminist, it's like the feminist movie of the 90s. And yeah, it was great to watch it again with, you know, with that in mind. And all the women in the class were the same, like I was. That feeling of like, oh my God, yes, fist pumpingly good. Everything that is bad about Spice World is not that bad, you know?
So, well, and like you're saying, no worse than any of the Beatles films.
Yes, which honestly, watching Hard Day's Night again, I thought, God, these guys are annoying.
You know? Hang on. Flag on the play. Take a step back, please.
Sorry. You can, I'm not, maybe I'm unjustly maligning the Beatles. Go for it. You can, I don't think
you're saying you watched Hard Day's Night, Kiss and the Phantom of the Paradise, and Rock and Roll High School, and you said the Beatles were the annoying band.
No, that's fair.
We watched the Village People, who were awesome, and also Prince. We watched Purple Rain. So that was the whole class, if anybody is interested. And rapping with Spice World, and yeah. So of course I love Meatloaf. I've loved him since, you know, he was first big. It was when I was in college and could never stop listening to Paradise by the Dashboard Light. But all the other cameos, I mean, they're too numerous to mention. I'm sure everybody has their favorites, but, and then Alan Cumming, you know, playing a role of a journalist following them around, and he's just perfect, and that might be the first thing I ever saw him in.
Oh, really? Wow.
So, I don't know. I can't remember what I mean. I remember when he came on the scene, but I don't remember what I saw him in first, you know. So anyway, that, I mean, this is also like what 25 years ago, almost 26 years ago.
It's a while. So. Yeah, I did see this in the cinema myself, and I didn't go with like young relatives. I just went on my own because I was a fan of the Spice Girls. Okay, I was in my mid-20s at the time and I loved the Spice Girls, so yeah, I went to see it not really knowing what to expect, and yeah, was just thoroughly enjoyed it and loved the, as I said, the self-awareness of it, like the stunt with the model bus going over the fake tower bridge.
Yes. Just
cracks me up every time. So yeah, as I say, like I've got a special edition, you know, sort of a metal tin with a VHS inside it, which I can't play anymore. Oh, nice. Don't have a VHS player, but I'm, you know, I've still got the set. It's the one with Jerry on the front, because, you know, there's a point. Yeah, who was everybody's favorite Spice Girl? Who was your favorite, Jean?
Well, I think it would be Scary Spice. Scary Spice.
Sarah?
Sporty Spice.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Chip?
Yeah, I know. I remember it's ridiculously predictable.
Chip?
Baby Spice.
You were going to say you don't have a favorite then, weren't you?
Maybe.
Monty, come on, I bet you've got a favorite.
Yeah, Baby Spice. I like her. Right. She shows up on Ab Fab a lot.
Oh, does she?
Oh.
Yeah, she's one of Eddie's clients that she just keeps having is Lulu and Baby Spice, like alternating.
Excellent. But yeah, Spice World. I'm fully on board with that one, Jean. Great pick. Sarah, what's your second pick?
Okay, so I was going to go with one of my favorite Star Trek films, but I figured I can, given Chip's already gone through the motion picture, I figure I can leave that one to Bring Out Your Dead. So instead, I'm going to go with another beloved sci-fi franchise. One which gave a backstory to a character that we desperately wanted. And when it came out, it was massively promoted. And it failed. It was the first film in this franchise ever to be a box office failure.
And are you going where I think you're going?
It might be. I'm picking Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Oh, my God. Good choice. Go on.
Because, now, ignoring the lead, okay?
Which is weird because it's the character is the name of the film. But ignoring the lead, there are two characters in this film that I absolutely adore. One of them is the character Kira, played by Emilia Clarke. And honestly, I have the belief that if this film hadn't bombed the way it did, I think we would have seen Kira crop up so much more in other parts of the Star Wars universe. I still have a hope that Kira will, but she's one of these, like, the trope of the ridiculously competent woman character that is dropping herself back to support the boyfriend when he's patently not as good as she is. And I just loved Emilia Clarke's presentation of Kira in this. However, the star of this show, and the reason I love this show so much, is Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian. Potentially the only time in history where a recasted character possibly was better than the original.
Oof. Controversial.
And I know that's a hard take, but I'm going to...
Wow.
Yeah, I honestly like Donald Glover's Lando Calrissian better than the original. And, I mean, he has a cloak cupboard. Seriously?
Everybody remembers the cape closet. Everybody remembers that.
yeah. That was just genius. I mean, I don't know who put that in, but it was brilliant. His droid that became the brains of the Millennium Falcon, which, like, RIP that droid, like, staging a slave revolt. I mean, it's awesome, but it was such a fan service. The fans demanded this film. It came out. It's got, it did a whole bunch of trying to explain away a couple things, setting up some ridiculous things. Like, anybody notice those little mini dice that were supposedly hanging from the...
In the cockpit.
That never had been in any film previously, but suddenly cropped up in all the films and TV shows since.
They gave an origin story to something I literally never noticed.
Right. Yeah. It was never present there. What are you guys doing? Attempting to explain away the 12 parsecs thing.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Was just like, it's I'm going to pick up on Jean's point previously. This is a fun film. It is genuinely a fun film. I will defend this film. I think it's great. I think the lead didn't do it justice. But everyone else, Paul Bettany, for crying out loud.
He's good.
Again, possibly this is leading towards scenery cheering again, but I loved him in this. Woody Harrelson as the gunslinger that is like the other, seeing himself in Han Solo and like, oh God, you're just going to end up like me, et cetera, et cetera. This was also directed by Ron Howard.
It was finished by Ron Howard.
Ron Howard, yeah, that's true, yes. Because it was originally written before, George Lucas wrote this before Disney bought Lucasfilm. Bought the Star Wars franchise from Lucasfilm. And, it got shifted. Now, could Solo be possibly better as an Andor? Maybe. But I just really enjoyed this film. A lot of people consider it to be like the worst of the Star Wars films.
Oh, God, no.
To which I say, have you not watched Rise of Skywalker?
I'll stand up for Alden Ehrenreich, actually. I thought that he was good. He played Solo well without doing an impersonation of...
No, that's true.
Harrison Ford, in the same way that Wesley is doing Kirk at the moment in Strange New Worlds without doing an impersonation of Shatner.
Do people Do people want Harrison Ford aged down? It doesn't seem like they do based on the Indiana Jones movie that's out.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
That's true. So
I thought he was okay in the role. I'm not sure I'd say Solo was great, in my opinion, but it certainly was good, genuinely good, and better than, yes, certain other Star Wars movies. But I think it had a little too much of that fan service, ironically, even though, you know, it was the fans demanding it and everything. If they'd actually left out stuff like the Kessel Run, I honestly think it would have been better received. They tried to cram a few too many things into it like that, I think, which was a shame.
That's exactly where I come from. You know, harshing other people's squee just really doesn't feel like the vibe today. But this is the first one, and I'm the guy who defended Eternals, but this is the first one where I'm having a hard time following where you're leading, Sarah, for exactly the reason that you just mentioned, Anthony.
I enjoy fans of I think there's a space. I mean, okay, sometimes there is too much cough, Picard, cough. But I think there's a place for a film or a piece of media that is designed for the fans. And maybe I could be convinced that Solo possibly wasn't that film, but I think they haven't done a film since that had the level of fan service that this one did. And I enjoy it for it. The thing is, when I came out of watching Solo the first time around and went into the movie theaters, I went out going, oh God, that was terrible. I genuinely did not like it. And admittedly, this was post Rogue One, and Rogue One was just genuinely is an incredible film. But it took me ages to come back to Solo, and so I rewatched it, and it was absolutely fun in a way that I don't think a lot of other Star Wars is allowed to be. And I enjoyed the fact that it was fan service, and I was picking up on all these things which I'd missed the first time round because I didn't feel like I enjoyed the film, that it wasn't Rogue One for me. But I enjoyed, as a Star Wars fan, having those things in there. And I think there is a space for a fan service film, and Solo is it for me.
Ironically, I saw this on opening night at the cinema, being a huge Star Wars fan, big fan of Han Solo. And me and my friend came out and we were like, oh, that was pretty good. And then we saw over the coming days, we saw the general reaction to it. We're like, what's everybody's problem? Like, it's fine. But yeah, by that point, the narrative was already written, I guess. Not helped with all the behind the scenes shenanigans that went on, I think. I think they, contributed to a lot of people's predisposition to bad feeling towards it, which was a shame. All right, Monty, what is your second pick for us?
I'm going to call an audible, which I should explain is an American football reference.
That's okay. I know that.
All right. Gene mentioned the genre of movies where a band appears as themselves. And I tossed out Rock and Roll High School, where the Ramones barely show up, and Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, where Kiss barely shows up and is dubbed over because they could not act. But I really like the movie Head, and I feel like a lot of people don't.
Oh, yes. Wow.
Head, of course, is the Monkees movie. Now, it's made after the Monkees TV show is over, and that's important because it meant the Monkees, as in the boys in the band, were actually in control of their own careers for the first time. The guy in charge of the Monkees music, Don Kirshner, had gone on to work on the Archies on the theory that cartoon people will not get mad and say they want to play their own instruments the way these jerks kept doing. So for Head, they went to Jack Nicholson. And this is, you cannot think of Jack Nicholson as, you know, movie star, sunglasses, front row of the Lakers, Jack Nicholson. This is the Jack Nicholson that had just made Easy Rider. This the Jack Nicholson that came out of Roger Corman. This is countercultural Jack Nicholson, and he made a countercultural Monkees movie called Head, in which, oh boy, I can't describe what happens in Head at all. There's no plot whatsoever.
I don't think anybody can. It's a fever dream.
Right, but it's a fever dream where these boys are trapped on television and need to get out. They're actually going through on screen what they had just been going through in real life. I think Head is a fascinating movie. And here's a fun fact. Although I love Head, I cannot stand the Monkees. I don't like their music or their TV show. But I love their movie to death.
I like the
Monkees.
Yeah,
I watched the Monkees. Yeah.
I've got, no, I don't like them as musicians. I've got several of their records. But yeah, Head is a strange, strange movie. I've only seen it once, but I watched it because I'm a fan of the Monkees. And at the end of it, I had that kind of, what did I just watch feeling.
What you watched was a acid trip, basically.
Yeah.
An acid trip of people trying to escape fame. Like, there's scenes in it where they're running from fans, and it's like Hard Day's Night. Like, all of the Monkees is a lot like Hard Day's Night, in my opinion. But they're running from the concept of fame now rather than individual fans. It's a fascinating movie. I love it so much. Head, won't you?
Wow. How long is it, actually? Because I seem to recall, I remember my impression at the time was that it felt like a long movie, but I'm wondering if that's just because I was so confused throughout the whole thing.
Original cut, 110 minutes. Theatrical cut, 86 minutes. It does feel longer.
Yeah, I'm not sure which cut I saw.
I want to be clear. It doesn't have a plot. It's very avant-garde, which is what I like about it, because it's not just some dumb sitcom. Burned.
Absolutely nothing like the TV show, yeah. I certainly remember that. It just, I mean, obviously they're playing the same characters in the same sort of super real versions of themselves. But yeah, it is, if all you know of them is the TV show.
I mean, at this point, they're playing themselves more than they are playing their Monkees characters.
Yeah, which then gets into a whole meta conversation about, well, which of those things is more real because they are still acting and, yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird movie. It's a real weird movie.
I have not thought about that film in a long time. Thank you, Monty.
I have never seen it, and I watch the Monkees. I own the DVD set of the show because it's a guaranteed child pleaser watch. And I
Head is
their...
not.
What?
Yeah, no, don't
Head
show
is
Head
not
to your
guaranteed
head.
Child
no.
pleaser.
It doesn't. Yes, I just has never. I guess I've heard of it, but I just haven't. I'd just rather put on season one again and watch, you know, Davy save the princess and while they run around.
Yeah,
singing and
watch it yourself, but do not put it on for your nephews and nieces.
Okay,
not unless you want to damage them.
No, do not want to do that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
All right, let's go around. Chip, what is your third pick?
All right, I'm trying not to make this one a moral crusade. You could say that some of the defenders of this movie are reacting against the movie's critics. So I'm going to try and emphasize what is good about this movie. I do think it is a crime that it did not restart the franchise, but instead the previous franchise took control of the wheel again. I just want to celebrate Chris Hemsworth and Leslie Jones and especially Kate McKinnon.
Oh,
you sniped me.
I love Ghostbusters 2016. And if I wake up in a certain mood, I think I honestly prefer it to the original, but not consistently. Just don't hold me to that. But I love Ghostbusters, also marketed as Ghostbusters Answer the Call. because apparently it was just too much to it's just too much for this movie to be named just Ghostbusters
to officially be the reboot. Yeah,
thank you, Chip. I love this film.
Yeah, so, I do as well. It was the funniest movie I saw that year.
It is so good. Now, there may be issues with the use of the former cast and cameos. Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig are the leads, but the show is the movie is really made by Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones.
Oh yeah.
And yes. And Chris Hemsworth is magnificent.
Oh, he's just amazing.
In this movie.
His comic timing is in this movie is just absolutely superb.
He absolutely deflates himself. I think it kind of gave him permission to take Thor in a much more entertaining direction in the MCU movies that followed. Ghostbusters is it's thematically similar to the original movie. The cast is good to great, as I've just sort of mentioned. And it took a lot of heat, not just from the misogynists who downvoted it on Rotten Tomatoes and just sort of the toxic fandom crowd that could not tolerate that their beloved franchise, which includes Ghostbusters 2, which is justly maligned. But it also took some heat from folks who said, well, it's actually not that funny. It is that funny. Yes. And Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones in particular are just that cool. I feel betrayed and saddened that, post-credits, Leslie Jones asks, does anybody know what Zool means? And I would have loved to have seen where that would have gone.
Mm-hmm.
There was an actual honest-to-God comic that did some multiversal shenanigans and crossed over this cast with the original characters. Who knows? But Ghostbusters 2016, answer the call. Love it. It is unjustly maligned.
And has a dance scene. That dance scene.
So that's actually, that's an area of criticism there for me, because it was clearly intended to be part of the narrative of the movie and it got cut for time or whatever.
Yeah.
But they left it in the closing credits and, yes, I'm glad we got to see it anyway.
Yeah.
Playing the saxophone or listening to the saxophone?
Yes. I just rewatched that.
I love that bit. Yeah, I agree. Like I said, that genuinely, it was the funniest movie I saw that year. And I never understood all the hate that it got. And as you say, people saying, oh, it wasn't funny. It's like, yes, it was. It was like, objectively, it was a funny film. I don't know.
I love this movie enough that I have not yet seen Afterlife. I'm having sort of a spiteful reaction to it. I should give it a chance, but I haven't yet because I think that this movie is so unjustly maligned.
This new one is not a comedy. It's a Stranger Things.
Yeah. Mm. And that's actually why I haven't seen it. It's not as a reaction to the reaction to this. It's more just that I read some reviews and I'm like, that does not sound interesting to me. But let us move on. Gene, what have you got for us on your third pick?
Ghostbusters 2016 was the only one on my list or
our first
my starters that was didn't have the word world in the title. So here's my third pick, 1991. Wim Wenders directed sci-fi extravaganza the world's greatest road trip until the end of the world. I may be the only person who still watches this movie over and over again, but I loved it when I saw it in 91. It is a movie that it just defies categorization. When it in the theater release, it was 2 hours and 38 minutes, and it was criticized for being too long, too unfocused. They just to give you an idea, the movie starts out in Venice, goes to Paris, Berlin, Lisbon, Moscow, takes a Trans-Siberian through China to Japan, San Francisco, and eventually ends up in the Australian outback.
Yeah, and then the world ends, and then the movie starts.
And all filmed on location. So for me, seeing it, when I first saw it, you know, so I was like 30, 31, and I had traveled a bit. But this movie, and also the main character, the protagonist of the film is a woman. And she is, unfortunately, the plot of the film, as I watch it, as I get older, I go, one, I don't like her very much. She's not nice to her boyfriend, Sam Neill, who, what is wrong with her? Because Sam Neill, from the time of this movie, he became my number one movie crush. And she's chasing after William Hurt, who is mysterious and hard to pin down and doesn't seem worth chasing after, to be honest. But she's trying to... but he's mysterious and she's looking for adventure. And it's set in the future for the time when it was, the action starts in 1999, like New Year's Eve is the turning point. It has all this technology in it. It's not technically a sci-fi movie, but it has technology that keeps coming back to me, you know, over and over again. The video phone booths that they have in Paris. She faxes him video. The main character Claire, she faxes her boyfriend in Paris some video from China. Even at the time I thought, what would that mean to fax video? But you know, this was 91, so at least 16 years before the iPhone. What I didn't realize until, you know, later, is one of the things he got right is how people would get addicted to their screens. You know, so by the end of the movie, people have screens to watch the video on and they can't stop watching and they go kind of literally insane. So whenever I'm like sitting there in bed with my iPad, maybe saying like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to sleep in a minute. And then I remember that scene. You know, I remember how the problem with video. And then one of the interesting things, and there's so many, I mean, the cast is amazing. But the screenplay is written by Peter Carey, who is a well-known Australian novelist. And the way that the issue of, you know, curing people of this obsession with their video pads is, you know, that he's in the outback. They've lost all power because of an electric magnetic pulse. But he gets a typewriter, and this is Sam Neill's character, and he just writes a novel. Everything that he had on his computer was wiped by the EMP. So he just sits down with paper and typewriter and writes a novel that people, when they read it, like sort of brings them back to reality. So the other characters. So anyway, I loved it. There is a longer 5-hour director's cut that Criterion released not that long ago. And I would say, unfortunately, it's hard to get the original edit because I don't know why, but because for me, I own it. I own the original edit. I bought it on Apple like decades ago. And so I have it, but they don't have it for sale anymore. And the director's cut, when I watched it, it was because I knew the original release version so well, I could, it's one of the few, if not the only movie where I can say that is new. That's a new scene that, oh, that adds so much to the understanding. But I think the original is good the way it is. So there you go. Until the End of the World. Definitely maligned, but still also soundtrack, one of the best all-time soundtracks.
Yeah, I was ever. Waiting for you to get to that. The soundtrack Until the End of the World is incredible.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it on Wikipedia. Lou Reed, REM, Elvis Costello, Talking Heads, Julie Cruz, Nene Cherry, Nick Cave, Patti Smith, Depeche Mode, T-Bone Burnett, Daniel Lanois. Like, wow. What a, that is a crazy soundtrack, yeah. All right, Sarah, what have you got for us in round three?
Well, most people, I mentioned this film and they don't know it. So I'm going obscure, like Gene, to a certain extent. I'm also not going to claim it's good, but
okay,
I love it.
Okay,
and I right. have rewatched this film so many times. So much so that, like Gene, I bought this on Apple just to have it so I can rewatch it whenever I'm in the mood for watching it. It is tropey to the extent that it is such the embodiment of this particular genre of film that it almost exists in the sense that it is all the tropes of this genre of film. Now, it's called, and a lot of people get it confused with a monster flick of the same name, but it is called The Host from 2013.
Okay.
And most people will not know this, but it was an attempt by Stephenie Meyer, who wrote the Twilight saga,
mm-hmm.
To create a new franchise. And it's the type of film that it was in 2013. All the films coming out at this particular moment were of the strong teenage girl set in a dystopia or post-apocalyptic scenario. Okay, so we get the Hunger Games genre.
It's the Hunger Games effect, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. There was a ton of these kind of films of mostly teenage girls, but some teenage boys, or like with teenage angst, existing in these post-apocalyptic dystopian characters. Now, The Host is set in a universe where the Earth is at its most peaceful time in history. Okay, it has never been at peace like it is now. And the reason why it's at peace is that virtually every single human being on Earth has been taken over by this parasitic alien race called Souls. And they are these tiny little tendrily aliens, about not even as big as your hand, that come in and wrap their tendrils around the spine, around the back of the neck, and take control of you. And the whole point behind what, and Souls do that, they spread from planet to planet and take over the bodies of the species that are there, but not changing their society profoundly, but just to experience what that society is like and continuing to live as that. And then they move on to the next planet and the next planet and the next planet. Again, I'm going to say it's not necessarily good, but if you love teenage angst and all the feels, then watch this film, because it is all the feels. You think that you would go in hating the alien parasites, but you end up in loving them and seeing, in a way, you almost see their point in a bunch of ways. And then the main film relationship is between a soul called Wanderer and a host called Melanie. Now, what happens most of the time when a soul takes over a body is that they erase. They're just like they've got far more dominant personality than human beings do, except for a rare few who manage to have two minds in the same body. And the female character Melanie,
played by Saoirse Ronan, yeah.
Yeah, spot on. It's one of her first early like roles before she started to become bigger. Although Diane Kruger and William Hurt are also in this. You get the conversations between Wanderer, and who becomes known as Wanda, and Melanie through this, their relationship. And they end up calling each other by the end of the film sister. And that moment is such a moment of emotional catharsis that you just, you love it for that. And I'm, again, I'm not going to pretend this film is good, but it is, it's the embodiment of so many tropes of this Hunger Games genre, of this strong female character genre. So much so that there's, you can see the love triangle coming, but it's an interesting take on a love triangle where Wanda falls in love with this one boy and Melanie has a relationship with another boy, but of course the two of them in the same body, so yada yada yada. And yeah, it is that tropey. So I'm going to go with the host, not claiming it's good, but claiming it's just simply worth watching as the tropey epitome of the post-apocalyptic dystopian Hunger Games genre. And it's probably the film that contributed to it dying.
I'm just looking it up. I've never even heard of this. I'm just looking
Nobody
it up on
knows
Wikipedia.
It.
And yeah, it's so Stephanie Meyer wrote a novel. Yes. Several years before the film, and the film's based on, so she didn't actually write the film, but it's based on that novel. But the film was written and directed by Andrew Niccol, who, you know, made things like Gattaca. He wrote The Truman Show, made Lord of War. So, you know, not a bad filmmaker by any means.
No. And I'm going to say the actual cinematography in this film is actually really good. You can tell this is by a director that knew where to frame shots. They're gorgeous shots. Again, this is tending to be a trend with me. But give it a chance. Yeah, again, don't expect it to be good, but it's just, it's better than it has any right to be. If you give it the fact that it's tropey and it's the epitome of this genre.
It was also the last major film review of Roger Ebert to be published in his lifetime. What a strange little factoid there on Wikipedia.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, technically this film actually made a profit, but that's because the budget was so small that basically if three people went and saw it, it would make a profit.
And also, I just saw that, yeah, it was made for like some like $40 million and it made $60 million. When you take marketing into account, that's not a profitable film. That's not enough.
No. So, no.
Wow, what a strange, what a great choice. I'd like to say, I'd never even heard of that.
Yeah, so if you do get the chance to see it, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
All right, well, before then, let's move on to Monty for round three. What have you got for us?
I'm just going to draft Hudson Hawk.
Guys. Oh, he sniped.
One of the very first films that we did on Unjustly Maligned with Dan Moran.
Because he's not here, I am free to draft it here. Hudson Hawk is a legendary flop that lost a ton of money and enraged critics. It won 3 Razzies for Worst Picture, Worst Director, and Worst Screenplay, and I'm here to inform you that, as usual, the Razzies do not know what they are talking about.
Yep.
The problem with Hudson Hawk, I have always felt, is that people were expecting action Bruce.
Yes.
Hudson Hawk came out in 1991. Die Hard 2 had come out the previous year. So we were like, yes, Bruce Willis is an action star. But also Bonfire of the Vanities came out in 1990. So people were like, maybe we're just sick of Bruce Willis. What else does he have? And what they got was comedy star Bruce Willis. Because Bruce is very funny. He was on Moonlighting. Moonlighting was a very funny show. Mm-hmm. But people forgot that because Die Hard was so exciting. I don't know. Hudson Hawk is a parody of spy movies, especially big-budget spy movies. As an example of what I mean by that, the tones used to unlock his handcuffs at one point are from the movie In Like Flint, and they're later used in Austin Powers as a ringtone. That's a true fact. Okay, Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhardt, right? They play the most incredibly over-the-top, top-of-their-lungs villains ever. And I find them very amusing. Now, I will say that Richard E. Grant does not find his performance amusing. In his book, With Nails, he has it's basically his film diaries. The chapter on Hudson Hawk is miserable. He hated working on this movie.
Which is a shame because he's so great in it.
Yes, he's amazing in it. I love him in this so much. I love Sandra Bernhardt in it. I love Danny Aiello in it. I love Danny Aiello in this movie. That says something. I have this, the novelization of Hudson Hawk, and it has an entire subplot that was cut out about a monkey and a steering wheel for a boat. I have seen Hudson Hawk so many times. In my friend group, there's a statement, which is, Hudson Hawk is always okay. So whenever we can't decide what to watch, we would just watch Hudson Hawk. I think it is a genuinely good, funny movie that people just didn't get at the time. This is not an ironic statement. Hudson Hawk is a good movie I enjoy.
I couldn't agree with you more. And yeah, I mean, Dan and I went into detail about it on the show. But yeah, I love Hudson Hawk. And again, like you, I do not understand why people were so against it. Because I just thought it was great. It did exactly what it set out to achieve. But as you say, people didn't want that. They were expecting Die Hard. And they got Moonlighting or something.
I will admit
approaching
that it's kind of goofy that they sing songs to stay in sync while
love that. That's the best part because it's
yeah,
so ridiculous.
It's silly and it's funny. Yeah. There's a scene where Bruce is on a stretcher in an ambulance and the stretcher slides out. Now he's flying through traffic and here comes a toll booth. But he's got change and he throws it and the thing goes up. It's great. It's very funny. It's
throws
not dumb.
The coins into the toll booth cup at like when he's traveling at 30 miles an hour or something.
Yeah.
Face down on a stretcher. Oh, brilliant. Your father earned $100 a week, son of a bitch. I love that film so much. And yeah, Richard E. Grant's brilliant in it. Oh, man. Hudson Hawk. All right. I think we've run out of time, so we're going to have to do Bring Out Your Dead. Chip, what else is on your list that you didn't get to draft?
With the unjustly maligned alternate definition of a flop, I'm going to call out The Iron Giant, which did not do well in the at the box office, but really, you know, started Brad Bird's career. And if you look at, you know, when Ted Lasso shows it on movie night for the team, and he says everybody's going to be crying at minute 70 or whatever, you know.
Yep,
darn right.
Yeah, it's a perfect movie.
Similarly, on that Bring Out Your Dead list for flops on the opening, both Citizen Kane and It's a Wonderful Life were commercial flops when they came out. They achieved cult status on their merits, and even though it's fashionable to diss It's a Wonderful Life by saying that George Bailey is an awful human being, I think the movie on some level actually knows that. I love It's a Wonderful Life and Citizen Kane, but the one that I'm disappointed that we didn't get to is sort of the opposite of Ghostbusters 2016. It's maligned somewhat for its fan base. But I actually really like Fight Club. It was a box office disappointment, and a lot of toxic bros took the wrong message from it. But how can you not appreciate a movie that opens up with the IKEA scene? I think that movie is got a little bit of self-criticalness, a little bit of that Paul Verhoeven Starship Troopers. It's criticizing the thing that it is promoting, but it's a smart movie, and I don't think that it portrays its protagonist as a good guy.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Gene, what's on your list?
I'm just going to throw out a couple, that I really did get to my main ones and sniped only once. So I'm happy.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'm glad you picked it. I'm going to throw in Roland Emmerich, an auteur whose work I never miss and is mostly maligned. It's hard to pick one, but I'm going to put 2012 in there. I liked it.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Yeah, I'll go with that.
I had a lot of fun watching it. I'm not going to try to defend the most recent one, Moonfall. That just was that's just maligned and faintly maligned. And I'm going to go another, I'm not going to pick all of it, but I'm going to say from the Twilight Saga, something that even within the saga that I liked, Twilight New Moon. I am Team Jacob. I like werewolves. I like Taylor Lautner, also unjustly maligned. And if you don't love him, you should just find his Saturday Night Live hosting clip where he reenacts his time with Taylor Swift and Kanye West at the MTV Awards, I think it was. Anyway.
Can I find it weird that he married someone named Taylor and she's also now named Taylor Lautner?
Oh, no. Didn't know that. Anyway, I love Taylor Lautner, so I like New Moon, and they're, you know, too bad if you don't. That's, I think, it's been more maligned by those vampire-loving people who are the Twilight fans.
All right, Sarah, what's on your list?
Okay, mine was a little bit longer, but I'll go through them. Alita Battle Angel. That did well in the box office, but got pretty much negative reviews. Pen. But I loved it. Yeah. And I think it's getting a sequel entirely due to James Cameron, because James Cameron. Star Trek Nemesis.
Oof.
Yeah, wow. I know. That was the one I didn't go with. But I love that film. We can actually have an episode on Star Trek Nemesis if you ever want to bring back Unjustly Maligned. John Carter, 2012's John Carter. I actually really enjoy that film. Shawshank Redemption was
what?
A box office flop.
Shawshank Redemption's beloved.
Yeah, but it was a box office flop when it first
was.
Came out.
Was it? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Same with Kingdom of Heaven, which I regularly rewatch, which is just an amazing period piece. Children of Men.
Was that a flop?
That was a flop.
Oh, wow. No, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. It's just so deep. Again, another episode we could totally go into. Chronicles of Riddick.
No, I'll go with you on that one. I like those. They're fun movies.
I love that film. Yeah, it was the same reason I like Jupiter Ascending, I think. That's why I didn't talk about it this time, because it's just ridiculous amounts of world building that just like, why? Why?
The unnecessary world building, yeah, totally.
Unnecessary world building. And one that everyone's going to groan at, but I actually really enjoy it. Green Lantern, the 2011.
Commencing the groan.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Validly so. It's possibly one of the not good but fun films. The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the 2015 one.
Oh, I liked that. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Again, total flop. Tenet from 2020. That was a flop, but that was a flop for pandemic
reasons.
Yeah,
that's kind of for COVID reasons. Yeah. Yeah.
So I kind of had that on the list, but I didn't go with it. Terminator Dark Fate. Really enjoyed that one. A Wrinkle in Time, which was a box office flop, but seriously, that film is just, the visuals are incredible. Yeah,
I don't understand why that was a flop, because it's such a beloved book and so many people were looking forward to it, and then nobody actually seemed to go and watch it.
Yeah, I know. I don't understand why that is a flop. It's just, yeah, I don't know. And then a weird one that was a flop, but every nerd loves it. So I was going to put it, I put it on the list, was Titan AE. Yeah. So that was my, including the host, Jupiter Ascending, Hudson Hawk, and Solo, A Star Wars Story. That was the 17 films I had.
Wow. All right, Monty, what's on your list?
The first one is Mortal Engines, kind of like Alita Battle Angel.
Oh, yeah.
I loved Mortal Engines. I don't remember much of the plot, but I remember the visuals once they're inside the giant machines that power these moving cities. I thought Mortal Engines was a ball. It says here, Popeye. I will direct people to my episode of Unjustly Maligned for a extended defense of Popeye. I will just briefly say, Popeye is good. It's directed by Robert Altman. You guys should give it another chance.
I still don't like it.
That's fine. Two, that I am calling maligned specifically by Roger Ebert because I'm still mad about it. Josie and the Pussycats, which he gave a half a star to.
Oof.
And Bring It On, which he gave 2 stars to, and his review reveals he did not even finish watching the movie. Roger Ebert, you were wrong. Josie and the Pussycats and Bring It On are both brilliant movies. Cloud Atlas, I don't love Cloud Atlas, but I love that Cloud Atlas exists, if that makes sense. It's a really weird movie with a lot of big swings that some of them they should not have made. But, you know, Cloud Atlas, I'm glad it's out there.
It's a pretty weird book.
I like The Lone Ranger. Now, you can't talk about anybody who's in The Lone Ranger specifically. And I realize that some very bad decisions were made. But the final train sequence, once the William Tell overture kicks in, that sequence is amazing.
I'll take your word for it. I've never seen it.
There's no reason to. And apparently this was a flop, so I'm going to shout it out. The Master, Philip Seymour Hoffman as L. Ron Hubbard.
Is that one about... You're right. Yeah. About Scientology and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Well, thank you all. This has been a lot of fun. You know, especially fun to have a bit of nostalgia for an old show of mine, which is gone, but not quite forgotten. I still occasionally get people asking me to bring it back, and I'm sorry, but I do not have the time. But I love
you
that
people... You just need to stop writing successful novels.
Clearly. I just love that people still, you know, still have that fondness for it. That's that means a lot to me.
I saved my pick for 6 years, and all I could think is if somebody else picks Waterworld... I'm going to just quit the podcast. I'll be disconnected mysteriously. Oh,
that would have been amazing. All right. Well, that is the end of this podcast. So thank you to my guest this time around. Chip, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure, Anthony.
Gene, thank you for being here.
Finally got to fan out on so many things that I've been holding back all these years. Thanks for that.
No, thank you for doing so. And Sarah, thank you.
I feel like I only just got started.
That's always the way with these drafts, isn't it? Yeah, there's never enough time. And of course, Monty, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Anthony. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to you all out there for listening. I'm Anthony Johnston, and we'll see you next time here on The Incomparable. Bye for now.